Yeah, I think that's, yeah, that's not playing back, is it? That's fine. Right. Good morning, Sam. Yeah.
Good morning.
As we've talked about, we're doing this oral history project about Caldwell's nurseries, of which I think you know quite a bit of information. Mm-hmm. So if you maybe just start by introducing yourself as to who you are, what you're currently doing, and then we'll kind of carry on from there.
So my name's Sam Yowd. I'm a gardens manager at Tatton Park. I came here in 1979, and so I've been here quite a while. And of course, when I first came here, we dealt a lot with Caldwell's nursery.
Okay, so you've obviously been here for quite a while, but you obviously weren't born at Tatton, so can you just tell me a bit about your background, where you were born, how you kind of got to be here, really?
Well, I've been gardening since I was 8. My father was a keen amateur gardener in Liverpool. And so when I started, when I became really interested in gardening, it was very a logical sort of development, really, to go and start an apprenticeship in the Parks Department in Liverpool, which I did. Spent 6 years as an apprentice gardener at Liverpool, covering all aspects of gardening, except that I was trained as a propagator originally. So that's the kind of background, looking at things from seeds and even subtropical and tropical material. And then to go on to growing orchids and all of those sorts of things, experience outside, of course. And then when I was 21, I finished my time and came out to go into private service. So I was in private service for 4 years, and then went back to Liverpool City Council, and then took up a post as a training instructor at the school for gardeners, and then went on from there until I became technical advisor for the department. And at that point then I decided that I was so divorced from gardening that it was absolutely rubbish. So I decided that I would move away, and went for an interview in Scotland, an interview in Anglesey, and came for an interview here and decided to take this job. So that's how I sort of very briefly ended up at Tatton Park.
So you say you were born in Liverpool?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
I was born in the posh bit in Highton, Highton with Roby, where they still used to deliver the bread by hansom carriage, and brought a basket to the door so with the loaf, and you could choose which one you wanted. And,
wow. So can I ask you when that was that you were born? Am I allowed to ask that?
It was April 1947. Right. So I survived the Great Winter of 47.
Marvellous. Well, I won't ask you about that just at the moment, because obviously I'm supposed to be concentrating on Caldwell's. But yeah. So when you actually came to Tatton, what was your first job here?
Well, I came to Tatton as propagator. They were advertising at that time. So I came as propagator, and my idea was to work here for 3 years and then to move on. But that didn't happen for all sorts of reasons. And really, that was quite exciting. So as the propagator, I had quite a lot of dealings with Caldwell's as the local, not only the local nursery, but the local place where Tatton had dealt for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I know you've shown me some ledgers you've got that there are Edgerton, Lord Edgerton and so on, ordering way back. Do you know much about that historical side, or is it more what you remember?
No, I think that the, I mean, obviously I wasn't around in 1700, but the day books cover that particular period of time, in 1800. And it's interesting, really, that to look at those, they're just copies of the pages from the day books. I mean, how it worked is you went to the nursery, and when you got what you'd ordered and everything else, it was entered into the day book, and then, of course, it went to the office, and then Tatton would be invoiced. So that's how it worked. So the day books were literally things that went every day from the nursery to different places and other great estates as well. So it's quite interesting to look at those day books and to find that you've got sort of one day, you know, they sent out 8,000 larch trees to Tatton Park. I mean, it's incredible when you start to think about the amounts of material. And the other great thing about it is, of course, that because we didn't have any information. There's very little information about gardens. You know, nobody keeps information about gardens. He didn't then, because nobody was interested. Providing there was food on the table, didn't actually worry too much. But it's interesting to look through the day books, because they are what they are. And because, you know, you can see that they also sent three packets of whatever seed it was. So you've got a great list of seed that was sent from there. And they're not just pretty things. You know, they're lists of vegetables and things like this, and varieties of peas and beans and all. So those sorts of things are really fascinating to me as a propagator, to look back and to think, you know, wow, you know, they were growing cabbage greyhound in 1700, you know, this and we're still growing it because it's still a good cabbage. So we've got, we're into the days of F1 hybrids and everything else, but to be perfectly honest, there's a lot of the bread and butter stuff that was still grown then and was introduced then and was grown. And, you know, they probably raved about greyhound cabbage then, and we still think it's a great cabbage now. So we haven't found anything better. And I think that's the great thing about looking at these old records, that some of the stuff is just fascinating. I mean, there are other fascinating things as well, of material that's, plant material that's disappeared altogether. So now we find it extremely difficult to find seed of Veitch's self-folding cauliflower. But, you know, in those days it was kind of, and that was bred because, you know, people didn't like yellow curds on cauliflower. And I suppose it was a kind of idea about labour-saving device, you know. Now, we have to go and we have to fold the leaf over when the curd is nearly reaching maturity so that we can keep it white. Well, Veitch introduced a cauliflower that actually folded itself over when it got to the stage of going over but still being white. So we still get seed of it, but it's extremely difficult to get hold of the seed of it now. So that's something that's kind of was fascinating. I think other things like the cabbage that doesn't smell when you cook it, which is another one, which was Cuvée Tronchuda. And that was, it's actually Portuguese in origin. But, you know, that was a cabbage that you can cook, and still is a cabbage you can cook and cook and cook, and it actually doesn't smell. So, you know, you can imagine that somebody had this cabbage, you know, bred this cabbage because they thought, you know, this will sell well with the aristocracy because they must be fed up with the cabbage smell like we are. So those sorts of things were introduced or found or discovered or whatever, or bred. And those are the sorts of things that you pick up in these old records, which are really fascinating, I think.
And would Caldwells have actually bred any of those things themselves, or would they have got them from elsewhere?
Well, in some ways, they bred plants themselves. A lot of them were chance introductions. I'm thinking now about the latest sort of thing, the Acer Campestre William Caldwell, which is probably one of the last introductions of Caldwells. But I mean, that was found just this as a chance seedling. You know, Caldwells were grown. Bill Caldwell gave me 3 or 4 plants of it, which are in the garden here at Tatton, as he distributed. I think he had 12 of them. I may be more than that, but he distributed them round to the people he thought would look after them in their gardens, and they'd be a great plant. They are a great plant. So that they had some boxes of Acer Campestre seedlings in the nursery, and you know, he just noticed that one of them was better autumn colour than the others, and so he wheedled it out, and as I say, I think he ended up with 12 of them, and you know, he named it Acer Campestre William Caldwell. It's a fantastic autumn colour and a very compact small tree. Acer Campestre is a really good, because it's a natural tree to us anyway. So it's a very good tree, and it's a very good autumn colour tree, very underrated. But this William Caldwell is definitely, it falls into the same class as some of the really good Acers, I think, to colour.
And would you still be able to get that anywhere, or is that basically those 12 and that's all that exists?
Not sure about that, to be honest. It's probably something that wants checking out, but it'd be a great shame if it disappeared completely.
Have you taken any seedlings from yours?
No, we haven't. We're just happy to have the 12 trees. I suppose that at some stage we could probably take some stuff off, some material off them, but we've never got to that yet.
You never know, still you time. So can you tell me, did you order from Caldwell's primarily by phone, or did you used to go in there and choose things? Or
no, because it used to be just up the road, so yeah, I mean, clearly it was just in the centre of Knutsford, so it was very easy to just pop in. And we never phoned up, we just went and collected, you know. And they still had, you know, the old seed cabinets that were full of seed, and they'd measure out, you know, 1/2 ounce or whatever, put into a packet for you. As, you know, they were proper seed merchants and nurserymen, really. So we would go and just, sometimes we'd order stuff to be collected, but we'd most of the time just go and it was a fascinating place to look around because the nursery was quite big, but it had a lot of rare and unusual stuff in it, so it was good to look around and find something different if you wanted something.
So how often would you say you used to go there?
Oh, probably once a fortnight, or maybe more in the season. It depended on, you know, the spring season. You might go a couple of times a week. Depends, really.
And that was all the time from when you first came to Tatton to when they closed?
Yes, indeed. It was a very sad day when they closed. It was one of those things, an institution, really, I suppose, Coldwell's. A great yardstick of horticulture, I think. And you know, it was a tragedy when it closed. Yeah.
Do you know why it closed?
But I could guess at a few things.
There's no sort of official story, just really the family.
No, I mean, they wanted to move from the site there. They already had another site at Ollerton, and they were quite keen to move there and open a garden centre, but they weren't allowed planning permission on that.
And they didn't want to try anywhere else?
No, I think because they felt they owned the land there at Ollerton, which was the Rose Nursery. So I thought that, you know, I think they probably thought that they, you know, we would not have a problem, but they did. So they decided if it wasn't going to be there, it would close, which was tragic, really, because not only did we lose a nursery, but we lost some of the really key guys in horticulture because they worked there. And some of them were getting old and towards retirement, so they kind of left. And we benefited here because we had one guy, John Prince, who worked at Coldwell's, and he came to work for me. So, you know, every cloud has a silver lining, perhaps. So that was how it happened. Yeah.
So what was his role at Coldwell's, and then what was his role?
Well, I think you'd have to check this out, but I think at one time been outside foreman, and he was quite good on fruit and things like this, so fruit pruning and things like that. So. Ironically, I'd met John some years before. I was an instructor for the Agricultural Training Board, and we used to do a lot of training for garden centres. And he came on a grafting course that I was running here. So I met him then. And then when Coldwell's were closing, they got in touch and said, would we be able to take anybody on? And I was looking for a tractor driver. So he could drive tractors, so I took him on as a tractor driver, and then he started to look after the nursery here. So it's kind of back to his original.
And how long did he work here? Or?
John? Can't remember now. Well, maybe 10 years. And then he retired.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you remember?
We still see him.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, he still comes up and he comes see us, yeah.
What, does he live locally?
I think he lives down in Weaverham Way, I think, I'm not sure. Oh, we've got a phone number for him somewhere, yeah. Yeah, Bob keeps in touch with him quite regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it might be another victim for our recording.
I mean, I'm sure he could tell you a lot about Coldwell's, and he could tell you quite a bit about Coldwell's, particularly in this kind of modern, whatever, you know, the latter days of Coldwell's, yeah.
He worked there for a long time, did he?
He did, yeah.
And what was the shop like? Who ran that? How many people were around there?
I think that Frank Passant, I think, ran the shop, from what I can remember. And it sold high quality tools and things like that, apart from seeds and plants. It wasn't massive, but it was big enough, and they could always get you something if you wanted it. Because in those days, there were plenty of horticultural suppliers. So there were things like Bulldog Tools and people like that who would supply stuff fairly quickly if you wanted it. So they only sold, because it was Knutsford, wasn't it? So they only sold high quality stuff. No rubbish.
And what was the shop itself like?
It was, well, the shop itself was more like a kind of summer house, you know. It was very light and airy, and it was very well organised, because that was the sort of... the front of house bit, wasn't it? So it was kind of reception area and everything. And they'd give advice on plants, that whatever you wanted to do, or how you were planning your garden, things like that. And the nursery was nicely laid out. It wasn't kind of like a tip, you know. It was very nicely laid out. It was very tidy. It was always very tidy. It was always a pleasure to go in there. The car park, I remember, was tiny. It was kind of, because you know, I suppose that they delivered a lot of stuff, you see. So I guess people in, you know, in those days, in the early days, didn't actually go to the nursery. They probably phoned up and had the stuff delivered, you know. So they did deliver a lot of plants as well. And I mean, a lot of the stuff was bare root. It was very, I mean, they had the Rose Nursery at all, and they had other nurseries as well. They had a big area of trees opposite the Dung Cow, which are all still there, strangely enough. There's some really rare varieties of trees there in that plot of land opposite the Dung Cow that were never, ever moved and still in the nursery rows. So they had a lot of places around Knutsford, so it wasn't a question. You couldn't just, if you wanted roses, you couldn't go to Caldwell's in Knutsford to get roses, because you'd have to go to the Alderton nursery to do that. But there, they only signed, you know, planted stuff and packed it and sent it out. So you might go there when the roses were in flower, but you wouldn't go there for any other reason. You'd order it through the shop. So a lot of the stuff was bare root. It was only when they were kind of under pressure, I suppose, in the latter days for plants in containers. But generally, it was all bare root. So you had to wait until sort of October, November, or even later, when they lifted the stuff to order it. So you'd order it maybe in the summer, but you knew you weren't going to get it until the autumn. That's the way it worked then.
So obviously they sold a lot of perennials and shrubs and trees, etc. Did they do annuals and things for people's just sort of gardens, or was it all very much more the perennial?
I think they did annuals when in the season. Obviously they sold, you know, they sold bedding and they sold you know, packets of seeds. So from that point of view, yeah, they did a certain amount of bedding. But I think the bread and butter stuff really was probably shrubs and trees. It'd be very good.
And that was stuff that they would have grown themselves?
Yes. In those days, there was nothing like, we didn't import anything. It was all grown themselves, yeah. The roses were all budded themselves. All the trees were raised by them. They bud and graft them themselves. A lot of fruit trees. So now, of course, we've got to go further afield to probably the only place I know now that does, you know, stuff is Morris Kelso. They were still doing their own. But then they would do all of the apple varieties and pears, and their catalogue was quite extensive for Caldwell's.
So they were really a very important nursery,
and you know, you've got to sort of think about the fact that now we think about garden centres. They weren't a garden centre, they were a nursery, they were nurserymen. It's a big difference between the two. They weren't just handling, they weren't the kind of in-between people handling goods for somebody else. You know, they actually grew the stuff, you know, from day one. They'd take orders and grow stuff for you, but it might take 5 years. They would put it on the books and do it and grow it for you. Yeah.
And they supplied all over the country, is that right?
Yeah, they supplied all over the country. Clearly, they were well known in the horticultural sort of circles, but again, they had the massive estates around here because they had Dunham Massey, Tatton, they'd supply to Arley, all of the biggest, you know, the big estates, the Tabley, all of those estates they would be supplying to, Toft Hall, lots of the estates that have disappeared now, so they would supply to them as well. And all of those were within sort of walking distance almost, except for Dunham, I suppose, of the nursery.
But they supplied domestic customers as well, is that right?
Oh yes, they supplied domestic customers. I mean, and again, I guess that the kind of domestic customers that they had in those days, in their heyday, were the domestic customers of you know, places like Lee Road, where they had massive gardens anyway. So they weren't supplying people who just had a window box. You know, they were supplying proper stuff. You know. And they would go and do the job. You know, they contracted work. They had contracted work that they used to go and do for people. So, you know, people would say, you know, Caldwell's came and planted the garden up. You know, so that was the kind of job that they did as well. Yeah. So as I say, they had outside foremen as well as inside foremen. So the staff, I don't know what staff they had, but big, you know, for the nurseries.
A lot of staff.
Yeah, because they had all these satellites all around their main office. So there's a lot of people employed. which is another great tragedy, of course, when the nursery actually folded, because it had, in single inverted commas, a detrimental effect on the kind of employment situation in Knutswood, which only has two streets, and about to have an impact, isn't it?
And so, obviously you're talking about lots of employees, but my understanding is that it was still always run and managed by the family members.
Oh, indeed, yes. I mean, Bill Caldwell was the last of the Caldwells still here when the place were closed and finished. Yeah, so I think he went to live in Mobley, I think, in the end. But yes, very much so, very much a family business. It was still Caldwell's, very much. Yeah.
I know their logo is King Canute, which obviously we've got lots of connotations with that.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about why they adopted that from, I think it was from a bottled water company, but you don't know anything about why they particularly...
I think that the bottled water company was at the back of Brook Street. I think that's where it was originally, because that's where the River Lily runs through. And I think that the Canute logo was used by a company called Gidman's, which is to do with which was a Knutsford group, but they used that logo that went on to be used by Caldwell's. What the link with all of that was, I'm not sure at all.
Now, you mentioned that at one point 8,000, I think you said larch trees were delivered to Tatton. Do you know where any of those are nowadays?
No, but I mean, you've got to think about that was the time when the parkland was being planted. So, you know, it could have been anywhere within the how many thousand acres that they had at that time, which was quite a lot more than there is now. So they could be in areas now that they've either been felled, or they could be in areas that we no longer own, as far as the trust is concerned. So, difficult to know, really. But that's one line in a book that I can remember. I mean, you're looking at lines and lines and lines of, you know, beeches and hornbeams and, you know, just the list went on and on and on. In the autumn when they were planting, you know, in the autumn and winter when they were bare root lifting stuff.
And I was intrigued when you were talking about the greyhound cabbage. That was a particularly good, strong plant, you said, but do you have any idea why it's called greyhound?
None at all. Anyway, I don't think it was because it bolted, but it may be. Anyways, the only thing about greyhound cabbage is that the leaves are grey. So it could have come from something like that. But I'd only be guessing without doing further research, really.
But that wasn't the one that didn't smell?
No.
Which was that?
Cuvée tronchuda.
I'll get you to spell that later.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. Yeah.
I've never heard about that one.
That was cabbage, yeah.
What else? Oh yes, you were talking about all the trees that still remain opposite the Dumb Cow.
Yes.
So, do you know who owns that land now?
No, I mean I've tried, and there used to be a board there for many years about who owned it, but I've no idea. I don't know whether it was bought by across the road. You know what's the Alderton Hall? I don't know whether he bought the land in the end, but somebody in Manor Lane in Alderton would be able to tell you, no doubt. Kate Panay might know who owns that land. She lived on the corner of Manor Lane for a bit, and she might know who owns that. But the trees are all still there. I mean, row after row, and it's really interesting to go in the sort of October, November, when the autumn colour, because some of those trees are just amazing. They're far too old now to be able to get out. At some stage, it'd just be destroyed. It's absolutely tragic because there's probably thousands, not hundreds, there's thousands there. Next time you drive past, just have a look.
What sort are they? What varieties?
There are all sorts of things there. There are maples and all kinds of things there that are in those rows. And I bet if you went in there, you'd probably still find some old painted labels or something that were there. Yeah, because they had that bit there. And then you've got the Dun Cow on the left-hand side. And then after the Dun Cow, you've got where their rose fields used to be. So it was all within kind of walking distance of all of that, yeah. So.
It's fascinating. I've got so many thoughts in my head. I'm trying to think what the best things to ask you are. I'm quite intrigued by the actual nursery itself and any sort of memories you have. I know you've talked a bit about sort of what it was like, but is there anything, are any particular stories or thoughts you've got about that?
I don't think so. I think the things were well labelled. I mean, that was the thing. And where the shop bit was and the kind of, where the shop bit and reception kind of area, that was always really, really tidy. It was always was. But, and then you kind of walked through the back and then you went out to where all the stuff was lined out down there. And then I guess they had all the other stuff in other places. So it was always tidy and clean and it did make you want to go in there. There was nothing plastic and tacky or anything. It was, you felt like you were going back in time, I suppose. And I think that was quite nostalgic for me because I'd known a lot of old nurseries before. So that was quite nice to go in. And the people who worked there were very knowledgeable. And that's the other thing that you don't get now. So they could advise you on things. So that was good. And they always had time for you. I think the combination of all of those things made it a pleasure to go. You didn't dread going to Caldwell's nursery. It was always nice to go there. There was always something you could talk about, plant-wise. So that was really good.
And I've seen sort of aprons and things that people used to wear. Did they have a sort of uniform?
That was about the uniform, I think. It was always collar and tie, of course, and then the apron. So, yes, it was always very much, it was, I suppose, a kind of nursery that served the gentry, I suppose. So probably the strap line could have been quite easily.
Presumably the ones in the shirt and ties and aprons were just in the shop, not in the actual nursery part. What were the people like in the nursery part?
I think a lot of them did just wear the traditional blue apron of the gardener. Just a blue denim apron, really. Just like a kind of woodworker's apron, but... That was it, because there was a hierarchy of aprons anyway in gardening.
So. Oh, was there? Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, you could only you wear. I think it was the journeyman who wore the green aprons.
And what was the journeyman?
The journeyman was somebody who'd qualified. He'd been in gardening and travelled around, and that's why he was the journeyman. And he could wear a green apron, and then he went to a blue apron. I think that's how it worked. So there was a hierarchy of gardeners by their aprons, which is quite unusual.
And was there a sort of, did you get the impression that the family were very in charge and sort of, they were the ones that were they very sort of well respected by the workers, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. I think they were. I never heard anyone say anything bad about them. I think they looked after their staff okay. So that was good, yeah.
Were the family members often in the actual shop or...?
Yes, yeah. He would go down there and meet Bill and regularly he'd be down there and working in the shop. So, yeah, there was you could always pick up the phone and talk to him, so...
Do you know any of the other family members?
No, the only one I know when was he a son-in-law? Was Don O'Leamin? Yeah, and he was kind of one of the latter ones as well. And he used to kind of run the nursery side of things when Bill wasn't there. But I've got a feeling he was a son-in-law, but not sure on that one. And he's still alive, of course. I think he lives in Yorkshire now. John Prince was a great friend of Don O'Leamin's. He's got contact, if you need a contact for him.
I'm feeling somebody's actually spoken to Don already.
Yeah.
So any other people you remember in particular?
Not from the nursery now, because, as I say, apart from Frank, I've had dealings with. No, I think it's a great shame that I didn't know them earlier on, because, but I wasn't here then. But I think there's a lot of experience there and interest.
And in the shop itself, you were saying that it was always interesting. Did they have kind of old seed boxes and was it very sort of traditional stuff?
Yeah, they had the old office there, which was, the cottages are still there. On the front of the road there, they were all Caldwell's buildings. So the seed store and the offices and all that were now cottages on the front there. So the original buildings are still there. But yes, it was a bit like going back in time. I kind of think that probably the shop bit was probably the most modern, trendy bit. But when we think about it now, it probably wasn't that trendy. Yeah, but it was at the time, I suppose. But that was very old and going back in time, the old buildings there, very much so.
But they didn't live in any of those at the time?
Not that I know of, no. Not that I know of. I never got to know them that well to know where they lived, to be honest. But there was a fairly big house at the back there. But I'm not sure on that.
I was very intrigued by the seeds and seedsmen because obviously I've got to have the plant to get the seeds, mm-hmm, and etc. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you know how they kind of started with their seeds? Would they have bought any in, or would they have done mainly seed saving themselves?
No, I guess that they would have probably bought in their seeds from, they may have saved some, but in those days there was Carter's at Manchester. Who would supply, their catalogue was amazing. So they probably could buy in from there, and there were other places as well. There were plenty of bees, of course, at Sealand in Chester. So they supplied a lot of seed and they supplied a lot of herbaceous plants. So I guess they probably bought in quite a bit of stuff from them, because it was on the doorstep and they had a massive catalogue. I mean, there were plenty of seed merchants and plenty of suppliers of material. So as long as you knew the people to talk to, you didn't need an awful lot more, really. So you concentrate. I think they concentrated really on things like trees and shrubs.
And you said they could get you pretty much anything or grow you anything.
Yeah, and they put your name in the book. And as I say, it might take you a long time. They'd either find it or they'd actually grow it. I mean, if it was a tree and a shrub, they'd guess it. If they could graft it, they would graft it and just do it for you, you know. But there was, once you ordered the stuff, you would get it eventually. But it was just wacky, you know, kind of idea that you had to wait. It was a bit like ordering your plants, wasn't it? That you had to wait till the autumn. It couldn't be lifted before the autumn, you know. And, of course, what we know is that bare-rooted stuff grows much better than container stuff anyway, particularly trees and shrubs. So you're better off without anything in a container. Yeah.
And you mentioned the Acer. I'll let you pronounce it again. The William Caldwell one.
Yeah.
And how many of those have you got still living at Tatton, would you say?
I think we've definitely got three. Living at the moment, which is still only small trees, you know. I mean, it's been a very compact tree. Acer campestri tends to be small anyway, but it's a hedge plant originally. But we've planted these out at the back of the maize, and they're doing okay. Yeah, they're doing all right. They're very upright. They're very kind of fastigiate, really, as opposed to what you would tend to think of as a kind of traditional tree. So from that point of view, they have a different habit as well. So, you know, chance seedlings, but then some of the plants that we grow in our garden were chance seedlings. You know, I mean, things like it's hard to imagine that a lot of these, you know, a lot of these plants like this ace and everything else came from one plant. If you think about Corollus contorta, which is the Harry Lauder's walking stick, the twisted hazel. All of that came from one plant. There's a chance find down and some old lady walking the lanes of Devon, and she suddenly noticed that this hazel in the hedgerow was different to all the others, and she took it home. And all these hazels that we've got now, this Corollus contorta, all came from that one plant that she found. She probably didn't get paid for it either, which is even more right. So, you know, when we'll buy it in from Holland, there's grafted plants and all of those sort of things. But having said all of that, the original came from here, from one plant. So, again, lots of chance seedlings. But people who were in those days, in the days of the heyday of Caldwell's, they'd be looking for things like that. So, you know, they, because they were growing their own stuff, and you'd see a batch of seedlings and think, that's an odd one. It's very not unusual to take out and say, you know, that looks a bit different. The leaf looks a bit different size, or it's got a slightly different colour, or it's got a bit of variegation in it. They might be for all sorts of reasons. If you take it out and grow it on, and think, yeah, no, it's grown out of it, or it's reverted to the type. So these nurserymen, they were plants people. They were plantsmen and plantswomen. They would know, they would be looking for things different, unusual. So lots of our plants sort of varieties were often just chance seedlings, not introductions from other parts of the world or whatever. You know, we get terribly excited when somebody like Roy Lancaster brings a new plant back from China, but to be honest, there's lots of stuff around that we just miss it completely. I suppose it's a bit like the four-leaf clover. But once you tune your eye into looking for four-leaf clovers, you'll find a lot of them. They are there. It's just we haven't got the patience anymore. So chance seedlings are a bit like that. And it happens all the time. We probably destroy thousands of them as well.
And when you say chance seedlings, is that because they've sort of self-crossed with something? Or?
Yeah, it just purely by chance something's happened to it on its way to developing. Just like humans, I guess, really. You know, it's just other factors, chromosome defects or whatever. Constant defects of the things, like viruses. You know, constant viruses are fine because that's why you get a lot of irrigation in some plants. So constant viruses are good. And things like petal streak in flowers that gives the bicoloured flowers maybe a white with a red edge to it. That's a petal streak agent, which is, as long as it's constant, it's okay. I mean, sometimes we talk about reversion in plants, but really what we're looking for in plants, and this is what these guys were good at, was identifying things which were constant. Or they would grow them on until they decided, was it constant? Or was it variable? Because if it was variable, it was going to be no good. So they were looking for stuff. They were plants people. They were close to the earth, so they knew what was going on. And they weren't looking for a quick buck, you know. They were looking for something that was different, that would, you know.
Do you think that was one of their big selling points to other people then, that they were really concentrating on these things?
Well, I think the fact that they were knowledgeable, and I think the fact that they were interested in plants, not just interested in making money, which is probably why they're not in business now, but yeah. Well, it was something that was great, you know. I mean, where can you go now? And I know there's this great argument about going and getting advice, you know. You only pay for the plant, you don't pay for the advice, you know. I mean, that don't make any sense to me. You know, I think you should be able to go along and you should be able to give advice about what this plant's going to do and everything else, or what you do with it. But then the counter-argument would be, you don't ask the girl at the checkout at Booths how to cook the chicken you've just bought. So, you know, in swings and roundabouts, isn't it? But I guess at the end of the day, if you're giving a service, then and you're interested in your customers to that point of view. I mean, we've moved on to checkouts now. Didn't have a checkout in those days. It was written in a ledger.
Were they still handwriting everything into ledgers when you worked with them? Or
yes.
They, yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, they were indeed, yeah. Still writing stuff. I think he'd gone to a diary by then, but even so, they were still writing things down, and you'd still get an invoice a month later, handwritten. I think eventually he went on to a typewriter, but very much so, still the same. I was trying to think the other day, I think I might even still have one of the last Caldwell's catalogues from Knutsford. Just have to have a look at that, but I've got a feeling I've probably still got one somewhere. Yeah, they used to produce a series of three. I think there was one that was, they used to produce a fruit one and a plant one and a, you know, flower one and a whatever. But I think I've still got one for the maybe trees and shrubs. Not sure. I'll have a look at it.
That's
good.
Yeah. Where do you know sort of where they would send those to, or how they would market themselves?
No, I guess it was just to the big houses and to their present customers, I guess, really. I mean, a lot of it was by word of mouth. It was not, they didn't particularly, they used to advertise. They'd advertise in things like the Nutswood Guardian, but that tended to be more, you know, the seed potatoes are in, that sort of thing. It was kind of what was happening at the time, you know. But I don't think on a regular basis they advertised there. They used to advertise quite a lot in the Tatton Garden Society Journal. And of course, I suppose the benefit of that was that Tatton Garden Society members in those days were all quite keen gardeners. And so we'd be looking at, Tatton Garden Society then had a membership of 2,500 members. So if you could get an advert in that was going directly to 2,500 people who were interested in gardens, then clearly you were in with a chance. So, yeah.
Were they open every day of the week, or was it a very traditional Monday to Friday or Saturday?
Can't remember on that one. I'm not sure whether they were open on a Sunday, but certainly they were open. It might have been just Saturday morning, perhaps. You know,
that's quite common, isn't it?
Yeah. Not sure on that one, but I'm not sure that they would have been open on a Sunday, to be honest. They weren't. They were that kind of company, really.
Mm. And were they open sort of early in the morning?
Yeah, I think they opened at sort of 8:30 or something like that, yeah. I mean, the guys would start at probably, maybe in the summer they'd start at 6:30, maybe, yeah. Certainly 7:30 in the winter time. So, they were busy and they worked till late. I suppose it was get the job done, you know.
Did they close at lunchtime or on Wednesday afternoon?
Oh, that I can't remember. It wouldn't have surprised me. If they did.
Sounds like that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think one till two for lunch or something like that, yeah. Somebody like John would tell you that. Yeah.
Well, they've all got to have a break, haven't they?
Yeah. So I think that was, they were very traditional, yeah.
And you said that they used to go and actually plant things for people in gardens. Mm. So did they actually design or just plant, would you say?
Not sure about the design elements of it. I would have imagined, yes. I think they would go along and to visit you and advise you on what you wanted. So it would be, I mean, but you know, in those days, we didn't talk about plant garden designers, did we? And people drawing plans. You know, you said you wanted, a rock garden. People would give you a price, turn up and build it. You wouldn't have all sorts of plans and whatever. And then when you would planting, they, my guess would be that they'd probably leave the planting to Colwell's, you know, and just say we want this planted, we'd like, you know, quite a number of evergreens and whatever, and they'd probably just go and do it in a price and do it. I would have thought. I don't think it was, you know, I think it was probably people who lived in those sort of houses. It was kind of the, you know, it wasn't for the likes of us getting involved in these gardens. I think, you know, it's nice to look out on when it's finished, you know. And I think the other thing is, there was probably quite a bit of kudos in the fact that Colwell's did it. Mm. Not just supplied the plants or, you know, we bought this from Woolworths and stuck it in, you know. There was none of that. It was all a bit one-upmanship, wasn't it?
They sound like they were well-respected.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but I guess if you looked at the day books and things like that, you'd probably find that they did work for Royce, wasn't it, who lived in Lee Road. People like that, I would guess that it was only at the top of the road. I mean, that was the other advantage that nursery had. It was literally just at the end of Lee Road. So I mean, you'd be an idiot not to go there, and people could walk there, you know. So I mean, it was kind of in a kind of obscure, as a kind of captive audience, I suppose, because people wouldn't want to go that far. Certainly all the gardeners who were at those big properties in Lee Road would be dealing with Caldwell's. Because it was handy, because they knew the quality was good. And what was the, you know, people in those days didn't go miles and miles to get stuff. They didn't drive 50 miles to go to a nursery to add a few fruit trees, to go there. And that was the other advantage of the fact that if you wanted I don't know, if you wanted Duchess's favourite as an apple and they didn't have it, then they would buddy for you and you'd have it in 2 years' time. Mm. Well, if you were only down the road from there, it didn't actually matter. You know, you could wait that time. And, you know, what's 2 years in gardening terms? So, you know, it's kind of, yes, my lady, we've got Duchess's favourite, you've got to wait 2 years for it. It was like, okay, fine, yeah. People didn't, there wasn't the Russian bluster like there is today. So people had a lot of time and, you know, I suppose it's like here, you know. But people went on, they never retired, they just carried on.
And if they did plant up a garden for somebody, would they then do any maintenance, do you know?
I don't know, but, I mean, you've got to think that most of these places would have a gardener themselves, their own gardener. But they may have done, they may have run contracts for different places. I'm sure they would have done. Maybe for, I don't know, offices or maybe something like that, you know, as things went on. I suppose it's like everywhere else, as things develop, you have to adapt to the new circumstances. So if you've got, you've got to learn to adapt and just to take in and do things that maybe really at the beginning didn't want to do anyway. So maybe that's the demise you get into. As you get threats from garden centres, you cease to become a nurseryman and become more of a garden centre, which is probably what happened in the end, or certainly that's what they wanted to do. Because the idea was they wanted to move to Ollerton, open a garden centre and have a cafe and whatever and all the rest of it. But I've never had that before. I mean, yeah. So I think that was what their idea was. So it was that time when garden centres were coming in. And, you know, I mean, I think they would have hated it personally.
It sounds like it. Did they, to your knowledge, did they do any sort of run any courses or do apprenticeships?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. No.
But they sound like they're very efficient.
I think they had generally. I think they had young people working there, but not. I think they probably had sort. Well, they would have young people there when they were doing their budding and things like that. They'd probably contract people in to do the budding on the roses. But I think apart from that, I don't think. I might be wrong, but I don't think so.
And obviously, when they were planting people's gardens and things, they'd know all the soil types and everything, and they'd plant accordingly.
Yeah, yeah.
Would they take soil in if they needed to? Things like that, or
don't know.
Do you not know?
Don't know. Don't know that one.
A bit too technical move now. Did they do anything like grow cut flowers to sell?
Don't ever remember them doing cut flowers, no. No.
And the other thing that intrigues me, you were saying about it being very sort of traditional, old-fashioned, how did they actually package things to supply to?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, we were local, so that was fine. So the wagon would turn up with it on there, you know, but it would all be root balled and done properly.
And would it be in just like netting or?
Well, if it was bare root stuff, it'd probably be packed in straw and cardboard boxes. That's how it would normally arrive, mm-hmm. bundled up and tied up in straw and whatever. Because they'd be lifting at time of the year in winter, of course, so they'd need to make sure that they would have the packing shed and they would lift it, put in the packing shed, ready to go the following day. So they would need protection, particularly if it was frosty nights, so they usually use straw. And as I say, and cardboard boxes, or sometimes it'd be in Hessian bags. Very traditional, yeah.
And was it all sort of brown paper bags if they were
Very old brown paper bags, yeah.
With their logo on or anything? Or?
No, I don't ever remember it having a logo on. I don't think they ever had the logo on those things. I think we just traditional brown paper bags, you know. There was nothing fancy in those days. They didn't have, like we've got now with Joe Bloggs Garden Centre on or anything like that. No.
So was that like that pretty much till they closed?
Yeah. And, you know, I think you could still buy things like wooden labels there and things like that, which you can't buy now. Very traditional, you know.
And they'd have all the sort of sundries like garden string and all.
Oh, yeah, tar twine and string and knives. They even sold knives. I mean, you can't sell knives now, can you? But knives, secateurs. But as I say, they tended to be the top of the range, you know. So all the knives would be Seynor, which were the quality knives, budding and grafting and things like that. all Sheffield steel. Not Sheffield, England. Not Sheffield, Japan. So Sheffield, England, yeah. So, and lots of things like that. I mean, and it's very rare. I mean, if you were thinking about spades and things like that, it'd be very unusual to buy, if you could afford one, a stainless steel spade. I mean, they were very traditional spades and things like that. Because Wilkinson's were making good tools in those days. So you would have things like never bend spades and things like that, which you can't buy now. So people were making really good tools. Bulldog were local because they were Wigan, so they were making good tools. So there was the quality stuff, really.
So if I said to you, can you remember the first time you ever went there? Have you got a particular memory?
No, I haven't. And the reason for that is because I'd come from Liverpool, and I'd come from the sort of Chilwell, Woolton area, which was very well to do. And we still had a nursery that was just like that one.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to see that there was somewhere you'd be dealing with was very similar to the one you'd been dealing with there. So
who'd you been dealing with before?
I think it was Turners or somebody like that in Liverpool. So it was kind of home from home, really. And again, it was very similar in the way it was run.
And a kind of last memory of it?
The last memory of it was having a conversation about they had applied for planning permission to move to Alderton, I think. And the sad days of selling everything off, I think.
What happened when that? How did that all take place?
Well, when that, they just closed down and sold everything off, so that was very sad. So I tended not to go there then at that point. But they were selling everything off and getting rid and clearing the site, really.
And who did you have the conversation with about the planning and so on?
I think it was probably Bill, yeah.
Yeah. You knew him reasonably well.
Yeah. He was a regular visitor. He was a Tatton Gardens.
I was going to say he came here,
didn't he? Yeah, and he was a Tatton Gardens Society member, so I knew him from there as well. So, yeah, he was a nice guy, Paul.
Did he ever do things like have visits for the society to the nursery or come and give talks?
No, there was never anything like that. It was just straightforward to business job and that was it, really. Yeah, I mean, those days we didn't do things like that. Didn't visit nurseries, no one went to nurseries, except if you want to buy something. And courses and that was all. Yeah, nothing like that.
Did he like it here?
Yes, he did. As I say, he was... I think the nice thing about it was when he phoned me up and said that they got these trees and he wanted them to go to only to places that he selected, and he'd selected Tatton as one of them, and he brought them. So that
he
was
brought them himself.
He brought them himself. Yeah. So they were, and then when we planted them, he came to see them, and I think that was the last time we'd seen Bill after that. Before he died, yeah. So.
Do you know where the other ones went to?
No.
Right.
He did tell me, but I didn't think it was that important to remember it, really. Local, I think. Yeah, but it'd be local, yeah. But I don't know who got the others. It might have taken some to Dunham Massey.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't know where else he would. I don't know. Maybe Ness.
Mm.
I don't know. That'd probably be about his furthest, I would have thought. I don't know whether he ever gave any to John Ravenscroft. Bridgemere.
Oh.
I don't know. I have no idea. But
your three are doing well, are they?
Yeah, they're doing okay. Yeah. As I say, they're just... they've hardly grown at all. I mean, which is great because, they're a great tree for a small garden if it was in production. We could probably check it on the net, see if it was still, if someone was still, if he'd sent it somewhere like, maybe Morris, he could still be propagating stuff. I don't know. But
So what sort of height are they now, would you say then?
Oh, about, what, about 30 feet maybe? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, I think you said you got a photograph of them in autumn.
Yeah. The colour's amazing. Colour's amazing, yeah. So some years are better than others, obviously, like all these things for autumn colour. But certainly they're very deep colour, for almost a maroon for, well, a sort of browny maroon for Acer campestri, which is normally yellow in colour. So it's a much deeper colour, which is probably why I picked out the seedlings very easily.
I wouldn't mind having a look at those at some point.
Yeah, no problem at all. It's just at the back of the maze.
Well, that's fantastic. Anything else you think?
Don't think so. I think that's, as I say, obviously the Caldwell records are still in the archive at Chester, aren't they? So
yeah.
They're there for people to see and enjoy. And they're very useful from a historic point of view. If you were trying to find out, if you knew your place dealt with it, Caldwell's, very useful to find out what they were growing at what particular time in history. So I think that's a very important record from that point of view. And to know what they were growing in Cheshire, which is quite interesting, I suppose, as opposed to the rest of the country. So I think it is a very important kind of historical record, like all of these things, but a very useful one, because it's still, in many ways, it's still a living record, rather than just a dead one, because we can still relate to it and still get things, as I said before, that they were growing there.
And so, I mean, I think I mentioned to you that we're planning to actually enter all this onto databases so that that'll make it available to more people more easily, rather than having to go into the record office. Do you think that's a good idea?
Absolutely, and I think that probably more important now than ever, because with various plant diseases that are rampaging through gardens at the moment and wiping out various things, or potentially will in the future, I think it's an important record to know what we did grow. When all our gardens are devoid of all of these things, it'll be probably nice to look back and think, yeah, those are the days. Things are really important.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Splendid. I think we'll finish there, shall we?
Mm-hmm. 5 seconds.